Hello and welcome to The Price of Music, the show that looks at the money behind the music industry with me, Steve Lamack, and Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge. How's the start of your week so far, Stuart?
It's been okay. Windy. I've been blown around a lot, but, you know, gets the brain clear, I suppose.
I tell you, I went out last night I met up with Lawrence Bell, who runs Domino Records, and I'd said to him, we'll meet in this pub, which is a pub around the corner from the BBC, where I've been going for years and years. And I said in my email to him, I think we've met in this pub before. Anyway, we met up and he said, you do realise we have been in here countless times. You didn't have to send us directions, right? I know exactly where it is. And it's at that point that I remembered that one of the nights that we'd met up in this particular pub was the night. So this was the story. So he turned up slightly late at the pub that night because he'd just got back from Sheffield, and he was telling us, because he'd found this band that he really, really liked and was really excited by their music, and had phoned up the manager because they were unsigned at the time, saying, you know, what's happening? And the manager said, well, you're a bit late because we've narrowed it down really to, I think there were a couple of record labels, or they were very close to signing to one of them. But Lawrence, it still went up, and I think they played a gig, and he went up, saw the gig, but he did get to finally, he got to meet the band, and he chatted to the band for a bit. Anyway, so he got on the train back from Sheffield, arrives back at the station in London, comes straight to meet us in the pub, and I guess we'd have been there about an hour and a half, maybe, probably into our second drink, when the manager phoned up and said, well, that went pretty well, didn't it? Would you like to come back tomorrow? So he went back to Sheffield on the train the following day, met the band again. They went out for pizza, and the band said, well, we'd like to sign to you. And I think he was a little bit flabbergasted, I mean, but overjoyed. And that's how the story of Domino Records changes within 36 hours, because that's when he signed the Arctic Monkeys.
Wow.
And he reminded me of that story last night. We were saying how just thinking about some of the pivotal moments in music industry history, and how some things happen just so quickly, just, you know, almost overnight. But anyway, enough of my anecdotes, because we have a lot of news stories to squeeze into this episode, including funding for new live music promoters, some record-breaking rights revenue, record store day on Saturday, and a big industry takeover, which is apparently off. But to start, have you seen this? Secondary ticketing firm StubHub are planning to float on the stock market.
Yeah, so this is one of those stories that isn't going to be to everybody's liking, I think, in the industry, because secondary ticketing is quite, it gets people's hackles up, doesn't it? And StubHub is one of the biggest players. And so the thought of one of the biggest players making loads of money from floating on the stock market is going to grind some people's gears. But yeah, so StubHub, it's been around for a long time. Like it used to be owned by eBay, strangely enough. In 2007, eBay bought it for $310 million. And then in 2020, its original co-founder, this guy called Eric Baker, who'd been kicked out. And then he went on to found Viagogo, which is the really controversial second ticket company. Yeah. He bought it back for $4 billion. And I was actually, when I was writing about this news story the other day, I looked back and there was some really interesting coverage of that deal. Because it happened in February 2020, which was literally as the live industry was about to shut down because of COVID. And there's this, I can't remember, was it Forbes or Fortune? There's an article that basically, the headline is worst deal ever. And it was saying he'd been completely done like a kipper because the live industry was now collapsing. But now StubHub is planning this flotation, going public, this thing. And apparently it wants to float for $16.5 billion. So four times what he paid for it. This
really,
summer.
Really? In what? In under 5 years?
Yeah, 4 years.
Yeah, in 4 years. Crikey. Is that a realistic valuation, do you think?
So the report said that this is I think it was valued that a couple of years ago, maybe when it was raising private finance. So it's a valuation they've been given by investment companies. And so they're hoping that will, you know, that's what they'll get when they go public. And I think the thing is, it's going to be one of those stories that within the music industry, people who don't like some of these big second chicken platforms will be saying, hang on a minute, like in that 4 year period, like a lot of people are struggling in the live music industry. We've talked about it a lot, haven't we? Like everything from venues to artists have been struggling with live. And yet this company that is, I guess, controversial is the polite way of putting it, has quadrupled in valuation. So there is something, it won't sit right with some people, but clearly the investors are quite excited about Second Ticketing. And it's one of those things where, I don't know, they're kind of, they've been growing and growing and they want to go public. But the other thing I was looking at was there could be some problems coming for it in the UK. And I can't remember if we talked about this or not a few weeks ago, but Sir Keir Starmer did a speech about culture and music. And one of the policies he announced was that he's going to regulate secondary ticketing. And you probably know more about this than I do because of your work with Live. But I think he's going to cap the maximum price you can resell tickets for and other regulations. So in a way, they could be going public just before, depending on when the general election is and whether he gets in, just before someone becomes prime minister who's committed to kind of cracking down on them a bit. So it's kind of, the timing's quite fun in that sense.
Since the headline which will run, which will state in 72 point bold letters, worst float ever. Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails is back with a new record and has been doing the rounds, doing some interviews. Amongst the interesting quotes, though, picked out from one of them, Trent Reznor apparently has said that streaming has, I'm quoting here, mortally wounded some artists. So I presume he's one of the musicians who claims he's been left prone on the digital battlefield, is he then? Is that what he's saying?
Well, it's kind of a weird one. Because like Trent Reznor is obviously Trent Reznor, Nine Inch Nails, you know, fame, and he's a famous soundtrack composer now as well. But he used to be an executive at Apple Music as well back in the day. So in its early days,
I never knew that.
Yeah,
really?
So I think what happened was there was this streaming service called originally Daisy, then it became Beats Music, part of the Dr. Dre Beats Empire. Then Apple bought that. And so as part of that, Trent Reznor found himself at Apple Music as one of the executives in its launch period. So he's as well as being an artist, he's been on the inside. And this interview was him talking in a way about what he'd seen and what he'd found when he was there before he kind of went back to being a full-time musician. And yeah, he's kind of saying some stuff that is kind of familiar in that what he's saying is it's really good if you're Drake. Like streaming is brilliant if you're Drake. But if you are a different kind of artist who doesn't stream so well, it's not good. And I think the quote went on to say something like, here we go, I've got it here. We've had enough time for the whole all the boats rise argument to see they don't rise. Those boats rise, those boats don't, and they can't make money. I think that's bad for art. So what he's saying essentially is it's really good for some artists, but it's been really bad for others. And this ties into this, I think it cuts to the heart of a lot of the streaming debates, which is that there are artists who are good and valuable and are making good music, but they just don't do that well on streaming. They don't suit it. It doesn't suit them. And they're struggling. And so it's been said before, but the fact that it's being said by someone who did have that kind of insider's seat at the early days of Apple Music makes it, you know, quote worthy, I think.
And do you think that there's the attitudes among musicians towards streaming, do they vary between age groups? Do you think that, you know, that there's a certain group of musicians who are very much the, you know, I remember the good old days, they were, you know, of the industry, and their outlook is slightly different. The people who were there making music before all these sweeping digital changes is different to people who have now entered the music industry in its current form.
Yeah, maybe so. Like, I think it's weird in a way, though, because the artists who remember before streaming are also the ones who often had terrible deals, and they're now talking about how terrible their label deals were. So there were problems about this. So it wasn't all rosy, I think. But yeah, I think if you come up into this world, you maybe just accept it. This is how it is. And I mean, we talk about it as a music ally a lot because we do a lot of the kind of how do you make money from music stuff. And I think as an artist, there are like, and someone once did a piece about this saying there's like 59 ways to make money from music beyond streaming, which is everything from merch tickets, all that sort of stuff, through to metaverse stuff and these, you know, weird wibbly wibbly things. So I think you have to hustle a lot. And I think maybe some young artists come in and go, right, I'm just going to have to get on with it. You know, I make this much from streaming, but I'll use it as a platform. And I think you're right. I think some artists do, it's having to adapt to things that have changed. And some artists have done that really well, I think. Like, so it's not like if you're an artist of a certain age, you're going to be automatically on the sidelines moaning about it. Some of them have rolled this and got on with it as well, found it interesting. But yeah, I think I think it just gets to the heart of streaming. I think how many streams you get, it shouldn't be the only metric of how valuable you are, if that makes sense, I think.
Mm-hmm,
and so I think we do need to protect some of the artists that are, like, them making music is a good thing for the world, even if they don't get 10 billion streams. And I think that's what Trent Reznor is talking about when he says, like, bad for art. Like, you don't just need art that's massively popular. You need artists to be able to survive who are making, you know, good, important stuff as well. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting. But I don't know what... I mean, he's been in that world, I think he mentioned something about the politics of that world. Like, you know, he was in there, he couldn't change it. So there's not any real solutions coming out of his interview. It's more that he's pointing out the problem, like a lot of other people have, I guess.
As wounded as he is, he might be heartened by this, though. The UK government is being urged to change the law so that musicians can be paid more fairly in the streaming age. I think this is coming out of it's a report coming out of another of those government select committees, I think, isn't it?
It is, yeah. The same one, actually, that held the inquiry into the music streaming that created so many headlines. And they've kind of, since they published their original report, they've followed it up a couple of times and given updates. And their updates are usually saying, why isn't anything happening that we asked to happen? They've got their new report. It's on, and it's one, they keep using this bloody word, and I can't say it probably. Remuneration. It's a really hard, it's one of those words that I struggle with. But it's about how musicians make money, basically. And it suggested a few things they'd like to see. And one of them's a blast in the past. It's a private copying scheme, which is something that's happened in some other European countries. And it's like a levy, a tax on, and the quote is, blank media and or electronic devices. So it's kind of from the days when you would put a levy on blank cassette tapes because they were being used to copy music. And then that money would be, you know, given to the music industry. But more relevant to today is electronic devices. So in theory, it could be like, you know, a small percentage of every sale of a smartphone, a smart speaker, anything you play music on digitally could go into a fund that then benefits musicians in some way. And that happens in, I think it's France and Germany. Like, other countries have done this, but we haven't. So that's one of the ideas. They want the government to bring in laws to protect musicians in the context of AI stuff. So making sure they have to give their consent and be fairly paid if the music is used to train AI models. And the committee's quite cross that the government hasn't done anything about that. It wants the government to consult, it says, consult with fans, music makers, and other stakeholders, which means labels and publishers, about an optimal rate for publishing rights. So it kind of wants the government to say, you know what, I think songwriters should get a bigger share of the streaming pie, which is kind of interesting, because that's something that the music industry has controlled, and it's saying. And then there's a big old, mighty old hoo-ha about, so last year the government set up this working group on creator remuneration. So it was basically people get everyone in the room, talk out the issues, decide what we can do. It was kind of its follow-on to the inquiry. It said we should change things. And there's a big complaint, which basically is there's lots of labels and publishers and industry bodies in this group. And there's only a few people representing musicians, and there's none representing producers. And so the committee was really cross about it, saying, look, come on, if you're going to talk about remunerating creators, you need more creators in the room. So it's kind of a few things. It's a few suggestions. It's a complaint. And the problem, well, not the problem with it, but the challenge for this is it's all like the government should do X, Y, and Z, but the government may not be around much longer, depending on when the general election is. Like, a lot of our stories are going to involve this. Like, we don't know who's going to be in charge in the next sort of 12 months. So depending on what happens with the general election and who's in power, this will be in their entry of, like, here's things you can do to pay musicians more fairly, I suppose. So to wait and see, I guess.
And so what's the response been from the music industry then after this report, the update of the report?
Yeah, well, there were two main responses. So the Council of Music Makers, which is the umbrella body representing all the different bodies that represent musicians, it's a very tangled nest, like a Russian doll's. It was basically quite critical and said, yes, we agree with all of this, and the music industry needs to pull its finger out, I'm paraphrasing, and, you know, give us good representation, sort all this stuff out. And then the BPI, which represents the labels, kind of put out a statement saying, you know, we're disappointed that they haven't recognized the value labels bring, so and so on. But we're pleased they think AI needs to be regulated because we agree with that. So kind of everyone said what you'd expect them to say. And all this stuff continues. In short, which again, I could say for so many stories. Everyone said what you expect them to say, and the arguments carry on. But again, this report does make some proposals. And so whoever is the government the end of this year, early next year, will at least have something in front of them saying, here's what you could do. Much like we were talking about the live music session the other day, that's going to have some proposals. So whoever comes in or whoever stays in is going to have no shortage of requests from the music industry about how they can improve things for musicians. So that's good.
Yeah, it's interesting you picked out that quote about talking to fans and music makers, I wrote it down, that the committee was saying that it also wants government to bring forward measures for consultation with fans, music makers and other stakeholders, which I wondered whether that was a very subtle nod to this idea of a fan-led review, which seems to be bubbling around at the moment and might well happen at some point. But that would be interesting because, as you say, the stakeholders involved who are being consulted, whether consulted enough or not, whether there's enough or not, there is the voice of musicians and record labels and publishers and people, but who's talking to the fans and what it means to them? So I'll tell you one thing which might be interesting. If you are, like us, a fan of music, can I just mention it's Record Store Day on Saturday? Because we've talked a lot about the increase in sales of vinyl of late and also about some of the pitfalls of actually manufacturing records. But Record Store Day, hundreds of limited edition LPs going on sale. Also, I noticed this as well, that there's a new record, a high-profile record shop opening this week on Thursday this week. Rough Trade Records are launching its biggest shop to date. So there's a new Rough Trade opening in Liverpool on Thursday ahead of Record Store Day, which I got the latest figures from Record Store Day. There's 270 shops taking part. There's 443 exclusive releases. Wow. 443 releases specifically for Record Store Day, which in turn, they're estimating, could put an extra £9.7 million through the tills if they're all sold. Last year, and this is according to the ERA, which organises Record Store Day, last year, the Record Store Day exclusives alone, accounted for 10% of all physical sales on the high street for the entire year. 10% of all physical formats sold last year were sold on Record Store Day. So it's going to be a busy day at your local record emporium. If you're interested or you'd like to know where the nearest shop to you, which is taking part, where it's based, how far away it is, there's a record shop locator and more details at recordstoreday.co.uk. Right, next on the news front, PPL, the UK's collective management organisation for performers and recording rights holders, has reported the highest annual revenue in its 90-year history. You better just explain PPL for mere mortals like me. What do PPL do? Who are PPL?
Yeah, well, so you say collective management organisation. So it collects money for the performance of music. And it's everything from like TV and radio broadcasts right through to like DJ sets. And I love this. In the announcement, it said one of the things that's been good this last year is it's got a new tariff for DJ sets and discos. And I thought, wow, are there's still discos in this year, 2024? Like, I like the idea of that. But of course there are, you know. Yeah. So where we've talked about PRS for music and they collect money for songwriters and publishers, PPR is collecting it for artists and the recording labels.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, revenues rose by 4%, so £283.5 million. And then public performance revenue, so that music played in public everywhere from gyms, pubs, wherever your name, they were 111 million quid. And that's kind of important because it's more than the peak before the COVID-19 pandemic. So it's kind of a sign that that kind of area of revenues, music industry, is now recovered from the setbacks in the pandemic. Because I mean, when everyone was in lockdown, those revenues plummeted because no one was going to the gym and no one was going to shops and pubs. So it's kind of good. And it's like, literally, I feel like every other week there's a story about like a collecting society or a collective management organization setting records, you know, breaking the biggest collection. So there's a lot of positive news coming out of this. And in PPL's case, these revenues are split. There's a good share of the revenues are going straight to artists. So it's one of those things where there isn't really a bad part to this story, you know, of... record revenues, but you know, it's good. It's good that they're collecting more and distributing more, and it means that money is going into artists' pockets and labels too.
So that's PPL. If we were playing music business acronym bingo, we'd be well on the way here, wouldn't we? BPI, PPL, and our next story is about PRS. PRS, the PRS Foundation, has launched a new fund for early career music promoters. Tell us about this.
Yeah, well, this is like a kind of good news, and it kind of follows up from a couple of shows we've done, doesn't it? Talking about like the when grassroots music struggles, it's not just about the venues, it's about the people who work in those venues and people who put on the gigs and book bands. And this is a fund for them. So it's PRS Foundation, which is a charitable offshoot from PRS for Music, the Collecting Society. So it's its own thing. And it's just fund for early career promoters, and they can get grants of up to $3,500. For anything, they're booking and promoting concerts or club nights or tours. And there's also like coaching and mentoring and shadowing and other kind of training as part of this. So it's about building their skills and their contacts, as well as giving them some money to kind of the business. And that's kind of, I mean, there's a few, PRS Foundation does a bunch of schemes like this, don't they? They do stuff for artists, do stuff for executives. And the benefits of this, it is money, which is helpful, but it is about helping people build those networks when they're in the early days and building the contacts. And I think, like, I can't remember if it was Nathan from Brutal Social Club or someone else was saying, like, people work their way up the industry and those first contacts can be really important as they all gradually get more senior. So it's kind of, I think it's a nice example of the industry looking at a particular area of grassroots music and going, yeah, how can we help them more? What do they need? And this seems like a good thing. And it's, I believe the idea is to give grants out monthly. So you can apply now for the first set, but I think it'll be every month after that. So there's not like one deadline. If you miss it, you can't do it for another year. It's going to be an ongoing rollout.
I wonder what the criteria is, whether how much experience you will have need to have accrued before they would give you some money, or whether you can do it as a complete novice saying, well, there's no bands, there's no artists playing around our neck of the woods. So I'd like to start putting on some groups, please. Can I have some money? I'll have to get the form. That's what we'll have to do.
I'm looking for the form as we speak now, I think. But yeah, usually I think you probably have to have some evidence that you want of doing it. But then nowadays, you know, you can put on shows quite, you know, in the back of a pub or in a school. You know, there are a lot of people doing that sort of thing. So I guess, I don't know, maybe it's like filling in a UCAS form, you know, finding a way to say, well, I had some people played some music in my back garden But it's a cool thing. It's a good thing. And I think they're going to have, a lot of people applying for it because, you know, I think as we've talked that there's a big network of people around the UK who are still, despite all those obstacles, who still want to book bands and put gigs on against all the odds sometimes. So this will hopefully give some of them just that extra bit of help they need to carry on.
We covered a lot of AI-related stories last week. Just the one for this week, I think, but one which might stir up a bit of a hoo-ha. It's the launch of another AI startup. And why might this one get people talking then, Stuart?
Yeah. Have I given you the word hoo-ha, or did you use it before? I feel like I say it too often. Have I transmitted it?
It's now firmly lodged in my head is the word hoo-ha. Hoo-ha, Dolly Parton, and I'll soon be a fan of the Black Crowes if I hang out with you much longer.
Can you imagine? I mean, that would be, I don't know if that's an achievement or a shame for me in terms of achievements. This is a company called Udio, which it's a startup. And its founders previously worked at DeepMind, which is one of Google's big AI teams. So they're kind of hardcore, well-respected AI researchers. And it's this new service, and it's kind of like some other ones. So you type in text prompts. Give me a new jazz wave song, 120 BPM about kangaroos playing football, or, you know, whatever you want. And it spits out music and lyrics, and then you can remix and tweak that music. So there's a few things like this around. But what's notable about it is it's got $10 million of funding from an interesting mix of people. So there's, okay, I'm going to say it in the American way, A16Z, because that's the way they say it over there. It was one of the big venture capital companies in Silicon Valley, like, you know, big Silicon Valley money. But also Will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas, who is, he's kind of a startup-y person. He's invested in things and founded things. Common, the rapper. United Masters, which is a music distributor. And then this guy, Mike Krieger, who's the co-founder of Instagram. And this is part of their pitch, is that what Instagram did for photography, Udio wants to do for music. Like, democratize it, open it up. Anyone can make a song. Like Instagram, let anyone take a photo and make it look nice with filters. So, which will instantly make some musicians go, ugh, I hate this idea. Ugh, it's horrible. And yeah, so the controversy stuff is, I mean, it's one of the best ones so far. Like, it spits out, I mean, it's all in the eye of the beholder, or the ear of the beholder, I suppose. But it's, in terms of other AOMs, it's good, you know, it's good quality. And the controversy is around, how did it get so good? What was it trained on? And I actually interviewed the founders last week, and they're really friendly. It wasn't like a tense interview, but I did ask, what did you train it on? And they answered at kind of length, while very carefully not saying what they trained it on, but saying stuff like, well, we think you need to train it on high quality music. And as long as you're not regurgitating that or infringing copyright when you put stuff out, it's fine. And that's kind of an argument that's used in the US for, this is why we should be able to train it on whatever music we like and not pay for it, because it's fair use. So they kind of were saying, without saying, that it probably has been trained on quite a lot of music without necessarily asking the permission.
That sounds like a very practiced answer as well. They've worked on that, haven't they?
There's a phrase, transformative. They mentioned this, you know, as long as it's transformative. And that is like a very specific thing as part of this argument that this should be fair use and you shouldn't have to pay, is like, as long as it's a transformative. And the weird thing is, like, there's this Udio, there's another one called Suno, which came out recently. And these are the two that people are talking about online, saying these are the two best new ones. They're getting all the buzz. And Suno has had similar questions around what it was trained on. Like, they haven't, you know, there's similar. So there's this kind of moment now for the music industry where possibly the I don't want to call them the Blur and Oasis of AI music. I'm not sure that works. But what if the Blur and Oasis of AI music are the ones that weren't trained the way the industry would like, that didn't have licensing deals? And what if they're the best because they've done that? What does that mean for the industry's hopes of making everyone do things the right way, pay? So it's kind of a little challenge to the music industry now of like, well, there are these things breaking through which aren't necessarily doing things the way the industry would like them to. And maybe they've stolen a march on the companies that have done things by the book in the eyes of the industry. And it's all gray areas. It's all still being legally settled, whether it's allowed or not. But yeah, so this is why Udio is kind of, it's getting a lot of excitement from people who've used it and say it's brilliant. And it's getting, I think, a lot of, from the music industry, people are going, okay, what is this? What have they trained it on? What does this mean? And what do we do about it?
Yeah. It has been, let me see, it must have been at least a week now since we mentioned the ongoing dispute between Universal and TikTok. But there has been, well, not an agreement between the two parties, but there has been an interesting twist.
There has. It's Taylor Swift. It's been a while since you mentioned Taylor Swift as well, hasn't it? Yeah. So her music was removed from TikTok because her label partner is Universal Music, Republic Records. And so her music went off TikTok in January with everyone else's. And suddenly last Thursday, it was back on. And if you went to Taylor Swift's profile and looked at the music section, suddenly there were loads of Taylor Swift songs you could use in your videos just like before. And of course, this was a story that wasn't broken by any music industry publication. It was broken by Swifties discovering it on TikTok. Right. Yeah. So they were the kind of the fan base found it. So since then, the Wall Street Journal did a, like, what really happened behind the scenes, because Universal still is in dispute with TikTok. And yeah, it's, yeah. And what happened was, so there's, I guess, two things to know. Like, one is that Taylor Swift has a very specific deal with Universal Music where she still owns the rights to her recorded music. When she signed with them, they announced it proudly, like, you know, I will get to own the rights to my music I make now. So unlike a lot of artists, she can say, I'm going back on TikTok, and Universal Music can't stop her. And according to the Wall Street Journal, there was this marketing meeting a few weeks ago with Universal and Taylor Swift's team. And they basically said, yeah, we're putting the music back on TikTok because we're going to use it to promote the new album that's coming out this Friday, actually. And it's a really fun sentence. It was like, the sentence in the report was, label executives were surprised. So I think it sounds like her team basically presented it as a fait accompli. We're going back on TikTok.
Right. And you can't stop us because look at our contract. So we can do what we want.
And in fairness, Universal Music signed that contract and they were willing to let her have her rights. So, you know, in a way, they've been not the big bad label in striking that kind of a deal. But yeah, so we talked last week, didn't we, about Impala, the indie label's body, and they were said them supporting Universal was a blow to TikTok. But this is like, it's maybe not a blow to Universal Music as such, but it's a boost to TikTok. It's weird because Taylor Swift as well, she's never been shy about criticizing streaming services. Like, she took her music off Spotify back in the day and was really, really kind of blunt about it in public. And she sort of challenged Apple Music when it wasn't going to pay royalties for its trial period when it launched. So she's always been very much like, if I don't think something's fair, I'll say it. And yet here we are with Universal saying TikTok doesn't play fairly, but Taylor Swift is back on it. So it's fun in that sense.
I mean, someone's done the maths probably somewhere, haven't they, and worked out what do we get more out of it by. We might only get pennies, but our pennies, that's a lot of pennies. And also we need the profile. So we're willing to, for however long, go along with this and put the songs back on TikTok.
And it is, I mean, the album comes out on Friday, the Tortured Poets Department. And, you know, it would have been planned for months, and TikTok will have been a big part of the plan. And clearly her team have been like, well, actually, there's no reason we don't have to keep making it that. And so, I mean, it doesn't really change anything for Universal. I mean, this Wall Street Journal report said that TikTok has tried a couple of times to restart negotiations, but nothing's happened yet. So, you know, it's in the same position, really, that they probably will get around the table at some point. But it does. I do wonder, like, what the other big artists who are on Universal, I wonder if some of them will go, well, hang on a minute, I want to be back on TikTok. And although I haven't got a deal that lets me do it without you saying I can, I wonder if it's going to have a few phone calls from, like, big artists saying, we would like to do the same thing, so let's figure that out. And that's where maybe the risk for Universal is the cracks start appearing, and it's defiance of TikTok, I suppose.
TikTok and Universal. Well, actually, while we're on the subject of ongoing will they, won't they stories, it turns out I think Warners aren't going to buy the big independent firm Believe after all. Can you just remind us about this story or explain it very briefly for anyone who may have missed the episode where we talked about this previously?
Yeah, sure. So Believe is a French company. It owns TuneCore, which is one of the big distributors of independent music. And it also works with artists like a label itself. So it's like part label, part distributor. And it's a public company, but recently its CEO said he was going to buy it with the help of some venture capital firms who were going to put the money up. And then Warner Music Group said, actually, we might fancy buying Believe. And there was a bit of financial jostling and a bit of like the French financial regulator got involved to say, yes, you need to let Warner look at the numbers and decide whether to make a bid or not. So it did, and it's decided not to bid, which I mean it sounds like, you know, it looked at the numbers and went, oh, something's dodgy here, but that's not the case. Like, there was pressure building, I think, on Warner Music of the independent community saying, we don't want this to happen, we don't want Warner to buy Believe, we don't want another major label to buy a big independent distributor. So it's possible that it just looked at the pros of buying Believe and the cons of what would be stirred up if it said it was going to. But whatever the reason now, yeah, Believe is probably going to get bought by its CEO and this consortium of investors. So it will stay independent. Although, I mean, the thing about big investors is they always want an exit in the future. They're like, they're not putting their money in for the, you know, they'll be like looking forward and saying, well, at some point we'd like it to get bought or go public again. So for now it's independent, but we'll see what the long-term plan is. But yeah, it's a good, I mean, the French independent labels body had come out and said, we think it'd be a terrible thing if Warner bought it. So did AIM here in the UK. So that's been headed off for now. So good news for indies.
Good news for actually some more good news for indies. We'll finish on this because it brings us nicely round in a full circle almost, because Domino Records are mentioned in this next set of stats. It's more figures from the BPI, I think, including, indicating that independent labels, they're doing all right and have been doing all right, and their share of the market is going up.
Yeah. So it's kind of, again, so this is the BPI. They publish this annual report called All About the Music. And quite a few of the figures in it have already been announced earlier in the year. So for the report launch, the press release was all about independence and some new data. And yeah, so independence accounted for 29.2% of album equivalent sales, which is kind of a sort of a metric where you combine streams and sales into one thing. And that's been rising. It was 25% in 2019. So in the last 5 years, it's gone from 25% to 29.2% quite steadily, which is kind of it sort of shows how much clout independents have, although it's quite fragmented. You mentioned that there's a table it's fascinating to me seeing this big table of the independents by their share. And I think BMG is top, but it's only got 1.7% of overall sales, but it's top. And then Beggars Group, 1.3%. And then AOL, which is owned by Sony Music, and then Domino. So it's kind of like a league table of independent labels. Right down the bottom, there's Human Resources on there, which is the company that Ray releases through. And it had like nothing in the two previous years and 0.1% last year, which is literally the Ray effect.
Right.
So it's kind of, you know, it's kind of just, I mean, it's the latest in a few stories, really, isn't it? Showing how in the streaming age, independent music is important. And it made me think back, like 10 or 15 years ago when I was first sort of started writing about this stuff, there was like a recurring news story where a streaming service would launch and it would only have the major stuff. And then Merlin, who represented the indies, would create a fuss in the press going, why haven't they licensed indies? Indies are important too. And I think nowadays you wouldn't do that anymore. You wouldn't dare launch a thing without having all the independent music, because I think all these stats show how popular and important it is, even though it's very fragmented between lots of different labels. Mm. So, yeah.
Interestingly, I think there was a point, it may even be just in the lead up to the pandemic and around probably about 3 to 5 years ago, there was a period in time where you just thought, how are the indies ever going to challenge the majors again, particularly when it comes to spending on advertising on the main streaming services and the deals that the majors are doing with the major streaming services? How is anyone going to, who's got a record label that started in a bedroom, ever going to get to the stage where they can compete with the likes of any one of the labels in the Universal Group? And yet, still, it appears that there's a swing back towards some of the independents now, which I think is really heartening, I think, and shows that I think they're somehow a little bit more flexible in how they go about things, and there's more freedom to be had at some independent labels. And in this new era, a lot of artists like the fact that they can do things for themselves. They can have relationships with smaller record labels, which are more advantageous to them than signing a regular deal with a big old, you know, old fashioned major label.
Yeah. And also, I mean, it affects a lot of things. Like, so Merlin, again, who go in and negotiate licensing deals for a lot of the indies with students. Like when they go in now, they'll say, right, look how popular indie music, look at our market share. So we'd like the same terms the majors are getting. So these kind of figures are important because they allow you to go in and say, we should be treated with a parity to the majors, because together we are. I mean, I don't want to do the cynical bit, but there is also a context to this where I think the BPI has a reason to shout about independent music, because part of its argument about the government shouldn't step in and do all kinds of regulations of music is because it's working well. Streaming's working well, the industry's working well. And part of that message is saying it's not just the major labels doing well, look at how the indies are doing. So there is a secondary reason why the BPI would want to shout about this. But at the same time, it is a trend that's real. So it's not made up. You know, it's something worth celebrating, but simultaneously it is part of those arguments about do things need to change in a streaming economy. And I think within independence, you probably get a lot of views on what needs to change and what doesn't. So but it's good. I think it's exciting. I think, like you say, like a world where indies struggle would be a sad world. And there's a lot of good music on major labels, but there's so much of the music that's like, not just that I've loved, but like the music that kind of changes things and nudges the industry in a different direction creatively. Like it comes from that world. So again, in a way, like, I don't know, I might be rambling now, but it feels like something that should be protected, but it sounds like on its own strength, it's doing pretty well as well. You know, people are seeking out this music and they're they're finding it.
Things better carry on changing, otherwise we'll run out of stories and then this podcast is finished. So as we are for this episode, thank you very much for listening. If you have enjoyed the show, please do subscribe to us in your podcast app and give us a review and a rating if you'd be so kind. And if you have a question for us for one of our specials, or if we can slip in an answer to one of your questions into a regular episode, we'll do that. But any questions, any financial questions about the music industry or anything that's bothering you about the business, email us at this address, Stuart.
The Price of Music Podcast at gmail.com. I nearly forgot that.
We'll rehearse that one for next week. Thanks very much, everyone. Cheerio.